Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 84. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's wonderful to have your company. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge and thank the wonderful listeners who continue to support this podcast via Podbean Patron, and thank everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. Your support and encouragement is very much appreciated. If you love the podcast and never miss an episode, perhaps you'd consider becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family, and in addition to receiving lots of Tudor-themed goodies, you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. August's prize is a copy of The Falcon's Flight, a novel of Anne Boleyn by Natalia Richards. A huge thank you to the author for sponsoring this great prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Thomas Cromwell and his letters is Caroline Angus. Caroline is an author and historian specializing in the 15th and 16th centuries. She studied Spanish history at the University of Valencia and completed three novels on the Spanish Civil War and following dictatorship before moving into 16th century English politics, concentrating on Thomas Cromwell. Caroline has a comprehensive website at carolineangusbaker.com and can be found on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. My conversation with Caroline straight after this musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Caroline. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
That's absolutely wonderful to have you on the show. Now, I thought we could begin by you just introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about your background.
Oh, okay. I live in Auckland in New Zealand, which is a pretty lucky place to be at the moment in the pandemic. Yeah. At the moment, I'm a full-time author since we can't open our bookstores, and I'm writing primarily religion and politics throughout the 1530s. Thomas Cromwell is my absolute favourite Tudor, so I am digging deep into him at the moment. I've studied history quite a bit. I studied over in Valencia in Spain, and I did Spanish Civil War, and then I just got hooked into the Tudors, and I've been doing that ever since.
Fantastic. And so was it something about Cromwell that sparked your interest for the Tudors, or was it something else?
I actually saw that, you know, the program, The Tudors, that was on about 7 or so years ago. I went to visit my mother. She was sick and she was watching it. And she's like, oh, gosh, look at Henry VIII. And he's got this wife and he's got this girlfriend. And, you know, she's going on about Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn. And I thought, yeah, okay, that's fine. But, you know, who's this this particularly interesting man in the background here, Thomas Cromwell. So I just Googled him, as you do, and he was, I thought, the most interesting character. And while the show, of course, isn't accurate, I still love it anyway. It's drama, it's got the costumes, it's got the general gist of things. And it was just Thomas Cromwell. I mean, Sam Neill was in it as Wolsey, and he's a New Zealander, so instantly I was interested. But it was Thomas Cromwell I always found the most interesting, because he wasn't royal or noble, he was just an ordinary guy, and that's what I liked about him.
Yes, and The Tudors is wonderful, and it really has inspired many people to dig deeper, and I think that's fantastic. So, Caroline, you're the author of many wonderful novels. Can you tell us a little bit more about your Thomas Cromwell trilogy?
Well, there's plenty of books out there with Thomas Cromwell, and of course, Hilary Mantel has made Thomas Cromwell an amazing person. So I wanted to make something a little bit different, and so I wrote about how he had a secretary, one of his many, many assistants, who was the illegitimate son of his patron in Italy all those years earlier, the Frescobaldi family. So I decided to put Nicola Frescobaldi in with Thomas Cromwell, and they are on opposite sides of the annulment for Henry and Catherine, and then just sort of see how it goes. And I wanted to write one book about them sort of going through the annulment, and instead I ended up writing three books about 10 years of their life together and going through and changing all the queens of England, because of course Henry was the one who got rid of Catherine and then put in Anne, and then he had to take out Anne, so he put in Jane, and then of course Anna of Cleves, which went horribly wrong. And so I decided to make the whole Queen Maker series of the two of them just sort of scheming in the background, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of fun. Now, you mentioned obviously that that Cromwell's life interested you because he was not of the royal family, he was not noble, yet he's played such a huge role. Is there anything else about him that sort of makes him a fascinating subject?
Thomas Cromwell is a real polymath. He can do, well, he did do literally anything he wanted. He seemed to have this huge amount of confidence that didn't have the same level of arrogance that you would get when you're noble. You know, when you're not born to something or you're not elevated, you don't have that sort of, that feeling that you owed anything. So he had to work for everything, and he worked constantly, but he never shied away from putting himself forward and offering solutions. He was quite bold. He would go to the king and say, I can make you the richest man in England. I know how to do it, or I know how to undo your marriage to Catherine of Aragon. And he just did it. He was just quite happy to go forward. He didn't have a great education, so he ran off, joined the army, and then went to Italy and ended up becoming a lawyer without any formal training. He knew how to trade in multiple countries. He'd go to expos, in the Low Countries, and be able to make friends everywhere. And he just kept going. He just kept trying, and it never seemed that there was a barrier. They had the class system, which, kept people in very strict roles. And he just seemed to jump into it and think, oh, I'll do whatever I want. And I just love that sort of ambitious without the arrogance sort of feeling to it. That's what I like about him so much.
Yeah, wonderful. And you make a good point. The nobles felt entitled, of course. There was that sense of entitlement that he didn't have because he wasn't born into it. So that's really interesting. Now, you're currently working on a book about Cromwell's letters and his fabulous remembrances, titled My Hearty Commendations. Tell us about this exciting project.
I've gone through all of Cromwell's mail many, many times for my work, for my novels. And I have all the work here, and I thought, why not make a book of all of it? There are two volumes by Roger Merriman from 1902, when he tried to put together Cromwell's letters. And I thought, surely there's more that's been uncovered in the last 120 years. There's got to be another way that you can look at Cromwell's mail and read it easier. The book is excellent, and it's an excellent reference book, but if you wanted to read it, it's a little bit complicated. A lot of people don't know that it's out there. It's sort of something more for people who are looking for academic detail, and I thought, why not make a slightly simpler version of it if people just want to look through? And I thought, Cromwell would write 100 letters a day, and yet there's only about 350 surviving in total. And I thought, this will be easy. There's no problem. And I want to go back to pre-pandemic times when I thought that and slap myself silly, because it's not simple. There's all the letters, there's the remembrances, there's the injunctions he was writing, there's all sorts of things that exist in his handwriting. And I've put it together and it's enormous. And now I'm trying to cut it down so people can sort of get a feel of who he was when he was writing. And nearly every single letter starts with, "After my hearty commendations." And I thought, well, that has to be the title for the book, because that's how he wrote to everyone, regardless of whether or not they were noble or just one of his servants.
And does your project include letters written to him, or are they just solely concentrating on the ones that Cromwell wrote himself?
It's got all the letters that he wrote himself. Okay. The amount of letters he got given and that have survived is massive. Yeah. I couldn't tell you how many. It's an infinite amount, and there would only be a fraction. And some of them, honestly, are a little bit boring. But I put in, you know, he'd write a letter. I would write why he wrote this letter, who sent him one first, what was the outcome of that, did he get another letter back that has survived, all that sort of thing, and sort of highlights of some letters he got, you know, whether it was, you know, there's letters from Anne Boleyn, there's letters from the Emperor Charles, the Queen of Hungary. And so, you know, if you get exciting letters or, you know, personal family letters from his son, for example, I've got little bits in about those. I haven't put the whole letter in because the book is already huge, but there is sort of highlights of the mail that he received as well as what he sent out.
Oh, I absolutely can't wait to get a copy of your book, Caroline. I'm absolutely hanging for it. So what do these letters, Cromwell's, you know, 350 or so letters, reveal about the man behind the famous name?
I think what it mostly reveals is how good it was at hiding the things that he did. Half the time it is what he didn't, what hasn't survived or what has been destroyed is what shows a lot about Cromwell, as opposed to what has survived. He was good at sort of hiding the details. He was obviously, a lot of work has been destroyed. It's theory that his servants destroyed a lot of his correspondence to protect him, and you can see what is being left and what has been thrown away, and I think that's what's interesting. But then every so often you get a letter that survived. There was a period through sort of 1537 when Cromwell was going through a hard time, and Stephen Gardiner kept all the letters that he received from Cromwell. So you get important details as well as the simple things that have been left to survive. And I think that's the most interesting thing. You can see what he was writing, but also what he was trying to hide. I think in trying to hide it, he's actually ended up highlighting what he's been up to.
Now, so illness often kept Cromwell away from court for extended periods of time. And this we see, you know, at various points throughout his career. Do we know exactly what he was suffering from?
There was multiple illnesses with Cromwell, and he nearly always got sick sort of March and April every year. Not always they could tell what it was. I think when his wife and his children died of sweating sickness, I think he was sick at the same time. There's no specific detail on that, but I would say he was very ill, judging by the letters he was writing. He, in 1539, would have been one of his worst illnesses. He said it was ague or tertian fever, which we would call malaria today. He was extremely sick for 2 months almost. He couldn't move. He couldn't leave St. James's Palace where he was staying. It caused him an enormous amount of trouble at court because he was away, even though he was trying to work from bed. 1534 and 1535 was the same. There's no detailed account of what it was, only that it was extremely serious. I would say it was probably the malaria again. Obviously not plague. He never had that. He survived. But I would say it was the malaria, judging by how he would go for 3 or 4 days, you know, crossing between life and death with fevers, and then it would break. But then a few days later, it would return, which sort of follows that line of the malaria. But when he got sick, he got incredibly, incredibly ill, looking for not moving for a month at a time. Must be extremely debilitating, especially when so many people are still wanting you. And in 1535, Henry actually went to Austin Friars to visit Cromwell in bed. That's how serious it was. And Henry, you know, he didn't like germs at all, for obvious good reasons. He was excellent at self-isolation. But Yeah, Cromwell, I would say it was the malaria, and he seemed to get it constantly. He was extremely unlucky in that regard.
Yeah, and I can imagine his stressful work just, exacerbated the illness and the matter. So Cromwell owned a number of very impressive houses. You just mentioned one that he was residence in there, including manors in Stepney and Hackney as well. Can you tell us about some of these properties?
Oh, Cromwell had some amazing homes. Everyone knows Austin Friars, right? Yes. In London, which he was almost obsessed with making bigger and bigger and buying properties around it. There's a few receipts that have survived about it. Stepney, he had from about 1529, he bought a little bit of land. It was only about 2 miles from Austin Friars, but was the country outside of London at the time. He had a big home there, and he built a second one for his nephew Richard. So they had homes together at Stepney. That was sort of like a private place that they would go when they wanted a bit of peace. He had a place in Cambry that was close to Hampton Court when Wolsey still had it. That was just another small place. But then he got the place in Hackney that belonged to Henry Percy. He needed to sell it because he had a huge amount of debt. He gave it to Henry, who gave it to Cromwell, who spent an enormous amount of money. It's called Brook House now. A lot of it was damaged after the war, unfortunately. But he spent a huge amount of money on that. He wanted to make it his prime country home because he also built Sutton Place for Ralph Sadler, which was just down the road. They were going to both live there together. And then he decided to bribe Henry Percy with the home at Hackney, because of course they needed the annulment from Anne Boleyn, and Henry Percy was so prominent in that. So we'll give you back your family home with all these renovations. And then all of a sudden it was gone. So he was then made Baron of Wimbledon, and they took the land from Thomas Cranmer to give to Cromwell, which included the huge manor at Mortlake. And it was Mortlake Manor that he actually ended up as his sort of prime country home. He spent a lavish amount on that building, doing it up. He had Gregory and Elizabeth Seymour's wedding there. Henry Cromwell, his first grandson, was born there. It was sort of their prime home. He would lend out other homes, but he never wanted to lend out Mortlake. It was his prime home. He had other places like Lewes Priory down in the south of England, and also Leeds Castle, which he did up for Gregory, but it was Mortlake that was sort of his prime inspiration for a country home.
Fabulous. I haven't heard too much about Mortlake, so I'll have to look into that. And Sutton Place that you mentioned, you can actually visit today. I visited a few years ago, and it's absolutely beautiful, just a beautiful little Tudor house. Obviously, there have been, changes made. But that whole area was known, the area of Hackney today was known for its healthy and, restorative air, and people used to go. It was complete country, as you say, which is strange when you visit it today. Very different. So talk to us about Cromwell's relationship with the king. Was his agenda perfectly in tune with Henry's, or do you think he was trying to steer the king in certain political or religious directions?
Cromwell certainly had his own, I won't say agenda, but he certainly had his own, preferences to things. But generally on a day-to-day basis, he would write out his remembrances. He would ask the king's permission for everything that he did. He would only do something with the king's say-so. So while he was coming up with ideas and he was putting these things into practice, he always had the king's blessing with what he was doing. He would ask first. There was only a few instances where he crossed the line, and Henry let him know without any trouble. Cromwell always wanted an alliance with Emperor Charles, even though he preferred Reformation, he always wanted to have an alliance with the emperor. So him and Chapuys spent a lot of time together. The correspondence between the two of them is invaluable with what Cromwell was up to. And sometimes he did push a little too hard for an alliance between those. Henry did get a little upset. Cromwell didn't like the French, so sometimes he'd be quite hard on them, and then Henry would pull him back from things like that. And I think, Henry was never really into the Reformation like Cromwell was. And I think between Cromwell and Cranmer, they did push. They did put all these ideas onto Henry, but ultimately they did have permission. They didn't go ahead and do anything without permission. But you could only really push as far as Henry's, whims would allow you at any given time. So while they did have their own preferences, ultimately, if you pushed Henry, he would push back. There was never any tolerance with Henry. Cromwell, as you can see, he died for pushing slightly too hard on different things. And I think that he was more or less in tune with Henry. I think they sort of worked together.
And I think there's a phrase that gets repeated often in those remembrances, something like you would not push, or something like to know the king's pleasure, or something along those lines that we hear a lot. You know,
yes.
Is it to know the king's pleasure?
Yes, the king's highness pleasure is. The king's majesty said that. Yeah, he's so often, he has asked before he's done something. I can see that. And almost, he almost asked too often. I would imagine if I was the king and someone came to me so many times, I'd think, oh, just go away. But I think they definitely did work as a team.
Now, we don't often think about Cromwell as a family man, but when he first arrived into Wolsey's service, he was in Wolsey's service first, he had a wife and two daughters, which we don't hear very much about. What is known about their lives?
Well, in terms of his daughters, precious little. Had he not written their names into his will, there would be no record of them at all. Again, with his wife, there's not even a sort of an idea of when he and Elizabeth got married. She was from the sort of same area. Her father lived in Wandsworth, which is very close to Putney. He went all over Europe and then came home to marry a local girl, which I really like that story. And they had three children. And roughly around 1520, so I think Grace was very young when he wrote his will, probably 3 to 4 years old, but little is known about them. But Cromwell very much was a family man. He had his wife, her sister Joan and her husband and her children lived at Austin Friars. Cromwell had two sisters and he was involved in all of his nieces and nephews' lives. He had them all educated. He made sure that they had marriages for the girls. The boys got jobs. They were given excellent tutoring alongside Gregory, his son. He had a lot of people with him. And even after his sister died, he took in his children, as we know, like Richard took his name and Walter took his name as well. There was another Gregory as well. He looked after everyone in a really wide extended family. So while he lost Elizabeth probably around late 1528, early 1529, you can see in his correspondence, things got really dark for him for a while. And then I think he lost the girls soon after, probably around September or October of 1529. Everyone was sort of in a panic. They couldn't find him. They were saying, I've heard rumors. Are you okay? I hope God sends you better times, things like that. And then he had an illegitimate daughter not long after that, Jane. That was another tricky thing for him, that he kept this daughter and he put her with Gregory for quite a while. And he was definitely a family man, even though he lost his children and he only had Gregory left over, plus Jane, who was sort of kept in the background. He was definitely a family man. He had a wide extended family. He even looked after his mother-in-law and considered her his own mother. And even his friends loved Mercy Pryor, Cromwell's mother-in-law. Everybody loved her. She seemed to be an amazing woman. So he was definitely a family man, even though sort of he never remarried. I don't think he could bear it.
That's such a wonderful snapshot. Like, I'd love to hear more about that. And your letters hopefully will reveal more about that aspect of his life, which is fantastic. Now, you know, you've mentioned the many hundreds of letters that you've read and reread and reread. Do you have a particular favourite? Does one stand out as one of your favourite Cromwell letters?
Cromwell is very formal when he writes, regardless of who he's writing to. But then every so often, I guess the mask slips a little bit, particularly sort of by about 1538, he was starting to get a little bit, I won't say casual, but I guess he was comfortable in his power. There is a letter, it's I think March 1538, he wrote to the Bishop of Salisbury, which is Nicholas Shaxton, and he was incredibly angry at Shaxton. He had been mouthing off about Cromwell, thinking it wasn't going to get back to him, which was, you know, it was sedition. He was arguing against the king. He was, you know, really rallying against Cromwell. And, you know, he was really, really angry. But even though he was, you know, furious, he was still going to give Shaxton another chance. He was warning him, I know what you've done. I'm not going to arrest you, but this is your one and only opportunity. What would God say? You know, he slips into Latin throughout the letters a little bit. And I think it was so bizarre, this letter, because he was angry, but you could still feel almost like a warmth in his writing. He was still prepared to give this guy another chance, even though he'd had plenty and he was annoying, and someone else, George Paulette in Ireland, had done the same thing and he was in the tower. It was bizarre. It was almost like he was trying to look after this person who had wronged him. And I thought, I just really had a strong sort of connection with a person behind those words. I really loved it because 6 months earlier, he had written to Michael Throgmorton, who was the servant of Reginald Pole. And I think maybe Cromwell was drunk at the time he wrote this letter because he was wild with anger. And he said things, and he's usually quite passive aggressive when he's annoyed with someone in his letters, but this letter was just outright aggressive. I was surprised that it was sent, actually. And he just absolutely ripped into this guy. How could I have ever believed that you were a decent person? You know, he was so mad, and he only ever did that once. But then, of course, he showed this other opportunity to Nicholas Shackston that actually he could hold it in if he wanted. And it was really nice to see those two sides. I think almost writing to Thomas Wyatt is always a good indication of Cromwell's letters. They were very close friends. Wyatt was on the scaffold with Cromwell, so he wasn't alone the day that he died. But sometimes, you know, Wyatt wasn't the best diplomat. Sometimes Cromwell did have to, you know, hurry him up or tell him what to do. But then there would be moments where he'd say, oh, I've never seen such a meeting between diplomats that had so many words but so little result. You know, he would be able to be honest with Wyatt. And in cipher, so he would have to decode it afterwards. But he had someone that he could trust and he could just sort of let his feelings out with. And I thought that was always really nice to see as well.
Contrary to popular belief, I think, the king's disastrous marriage to Anne of Cleves was really not the end for Cromwell. Why is it that Cromwell, and I know this is a very complicated topic that I'm asking you about, why is it that Cromwell fell out of favour? And in the end, what was it that prompted Henry to put one of his most, if not the most, loyal minister to death?
It was a really complicated time. Even since the moment that Jane Seymour died, within days of her death, Cromwell had to start looking for wives. It was within a week. And the negotiations went on and on and on, and there was precious little. No one would marry Henry. It was all talk. You know, the women's opinions weren't really taken into account, but they couldn't settle on any terms. No matter how much Cromwell tried, no one would marry Henry. And I can't blame them. That's how the Germans got a foothold, because there was no other options, really. But Anna of Cleves, she was sort of floated as an idea very early on. She was an excellent choice. She had a Catholic mother who was very powerful. Her brother was a strong evangelical. Her sister was married to the Elector of Saxony, who had a huge army. So if you were looking for an alliance, they were an excellent choice. Anna didn't, I don't know, her opinion was never really asked whether or not she wanted to marry Henry, but she seemed happy to go along with it. The negotiations went fine. The Germans wanted to negotiate sort of the Reformation within England. They wanted to make sure that their religious sort of opinions aligned, and they didn't. And they had to go back and forward and back and forward. So it was a long process. But then when Holbein's painting of Anna turned up, Henry took one look at it and went, yeah, great, do it, sign the papers, off we go. And Cromwell was suddenly in a panic. He had about a month to get everything prepared. But Anna's coming over to England took about 7 weeks. She had about 40 stops along the way. Cromwell had to keep getting different passports for her. And then in that time, her brother, the Duke of Cleves, made a claim to the Duchy of Guelders in northern Germany. And Emperor Charles also had a claim to it. And it was quite complicated, and they both threatened war. They were already mad at each other. They were part of the empire, but Germany was breaking away in religious sense. Charles had sort of allowed them to because they weren't causing trouble, but now all of a sudden we could go to war over this little state. And France was on the border, and they went, well, we don't want anything to do with this. And suddenly, if Henry married Anna, he would be in alliance with the Germans and have to fight the emperor. And it all just fell apart. She turned up, and the prospect of it all, you know, suddenly, of course, she was repellent because she was suddenly the symbol that they were going to have to go to war against Emperor Charles. And it didn't necessarily mean they would win. They had the Reformation sort of backing, but was it enough? And Henry sort of buckled. He was quite weak on it. You'd think he'd want to charge in and start killing people. He had done it before, but he didn't. And to marry Anna meant to align his country, and he panicked. But Cromwell had done the paperwork. It was watertight. They couldn't do anything, so he married her. But non-consummation was definitely a way to get out of it. And Henry, being the big, fat, pus-filled man that he was, if he couldn't with Anna, then it wasn't really a problem. Sort of negotiations went on throughout the marriage. You know, over those first few months, everyone loved Anna. Everyone received her really well. She was considered very pretty and very polite and very accommodating. But Henry didn't want anything to do with her and everything that came along with her. That was the problem. And then it seemed that maybe it was going to be okay, and Cromwell was made an earl, which completely stumped everyone at court. They couldn't believe it, you know, that Henry still believed in Cromwell after all this time, because he thought, I'm going to get out of this. It's going to be all right. But then the enemies of Cromwell were the problem. They were sick of it. They were sick that finally maybe they would get rid of him with Anna of Cleves and all this problem with possible war. And Henry still backed Cromwell, and they had to get together and try and find something, because Cromwell had made a few mistakes in that past year. He had said things that weren't appropriate. After his illness, he never seemed to quite come right. He would slip, and he would, you know, he said to Stephen Gardiner that he would fight the king against the Reformation if he had to. And that sounds like treason. Yeah, it sounds like heresy. You can twist it. He probably looked back and thought, oh my God, what did I say that for? I'm an idiot, you know, and it was overblown. You know, it was just little things that sort of, if you brought them all together, it looked really bad. And Henry had the paperwork that shown him, you know, Cromwell's heretic. He's plotting against you. He could marry the Lady Mary, because he and Mary were always very close. And Henry still wavered until one night at Austin Friars, Cromwell was sitting tired at his desk, and he said to Risley, I always say Rithersley when I look at his name, Risley, and he muttered something about how the king wasn't able to sleep with Anna. Not that he didn't want to, that impotence was sort of a thing, because only Cromwell and the Earl of Southampton knew that. And when he let that slip, Risley ran straight to the king, mouthed off about it. And of course, oh, Cromwell's telling people you're impotent. That's it. Henry just, he signed the paperwork, arrest this, you know, this man, I hate him. I can only imagine the language that was used. And it went from everything was fine. Cromwell went to Parliament that morning, and he turned up late. I still don't know why he was late for the Privy Council meeting. I don't think I'm ever going to find out why. And they were there ready to arrest him. It went from totally fine to out of control all at once. And he was betrayed by people that he truly thought he could trust. They were living in his house. So it would have been a really crushing blow.
Gosh, what an incredible story. Just that period itself warrants a really close reading. It's absolutely amazing. And he wasn't a spring chicken by then, was he? Was he in his 60s, or was he in his late 50s by then?
He was in his late 50s by then. Yeah. Success at court came quite late for Cromwell. By the time that he was in the king's service, he was 45. He had already lived quite a successful life. He'd made a lot of money. He could have easily gone on and just lived his own life and never gone to court. He didn't need the money. He didn't need the glory. He had everything that he wanted. Before he worked for the king, he was calling in his debts after his wife died. I think he was feeling particularly vulnerable. And I calculated it, and it was almost $2 million in today's money. £2 million people owed him. He had a lot of money. If you can loan that out and people needed to give it back, it's, you know, it's mind-boggling. He had done very well for himself already. So going into the service of the king was not necessary for him. He never sought it out.
Yeah.
And I think that made a difference too, because he didn't go in looking for power or money or popularity. I think that helped him because he was able to get on with it rather than the bickering that tend to go on between different people.
All right. So, Caroline, if our listeners would like to find out more about your work and hopefully, you know, be alerted when your new book comes out, as I would like to be, where could they go?
My website is carolineangusbaker.com. Sorry for having such a long name. I have all my information about the new book. I'm trying. It should be up as a pre-order on Amazon very soon. It's out November 5. Great. Everything's been a bit delayed with COVID-19 everywhere around the world, so it's a bit tricky. It'll be on my website. It'll come up on Amazon. All my other books are on there at the moment. And also, I'm on Twitter constantly, always talking. My handle is writer_Caroline. And I'm also Caroline Angus on Facebook if you're looking for me.
Fantastic. Excellent. That sounds like a great way to connect. Now, we're up to the time of our episode where we play our little game of 10 to go, as I call it. So are you ready for your 10 questions?
Okay, I can try.
Easy, you'll be fine. So first one, nice and easy. What was the last movie that you watched, if you could remember this COVID days?
Oh my God, the last movie I watched, it would have been Jurassic Park for about the thousandth time with my children. The last new release movie, I could not tell you.
That's a family favourite, that one. That's good to rewatch. Mm. And what's one of the books that you currently have on your side table?
Ooh, yikes. On my side table at the moment, I have got a few Matthew Lewis books because I've been looking into a lot of Henry III stuff. I love his Survival of the Princes of the Tower. I've read that about 3 times now. I've also got Nicola Tallis. I'm reading her book on Margaret Beaufort. I think that is an excellent book. I've read it before and I'm reading it again because it's just so good.
That's fantastic. And for anyone listening, I have also spoken to both those wonderful authors and historians, so you can listen to those episodes too. And the one about the princes in the tower, you may need to accompany that with a substantial glass of wine or something similar, because it is a little bit like your head just goes, oh my goodness, with all the theories. But it's really fantastic.
Yeah, it just sort of goes in a whole lot of different theories.
Absolutely.
I love the theories. I would like to write a book based on those theories alone. I could definitely do that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Now, at school, what was your favorite subject?
Oh, none. That was easy. I hated school passionately.
Oh,
I can remember I did a study at college about the Middle Ages, and that was sort of the first time I'd ever been interested in anything. But I hated all school. It was not until after I left school and decided to go to university and study history that I really got into it. So absolutely anything historical, I was just desperate to get involved. Yeah.
And that's really inspiring for anyone listening who perhaps didn't do that well at school, or who wasn't that interested, that you can always come back and, you know, do further studies and further education. So that's really cool. What is a favorite game or a sport that you enjoy watching or playing?
Most of my life I've spent in the world of sailing, which I know sounds a little strange. I started life as a sail maker when I was young. I did my apprenticeship. Been around the world a few times with different boats, going to different regattas and events. So that's always my absolute favourite sport.
And have you ever had a nickname?
No, I've never had a nickname. I've always just been Caroline. Yeah. I hate being called Carolyn. It always really annoys me when people say that. No, I've never had a nickname. If someone would like to give me one, it would be quite exciting. It would be like a real novelty.
All right, there you go. There's a challenge for someone listening. Now, if you had to be stranded on a deserted island with someone from Tudor history, I think I sort of feel like I know who you're going to say.
Oh,
who
gee,
would it be? Maybe we've got to leave him out.
Aside from him, oh my God, I don't. Catherine of Aragon, I think.
Because,
she was everything that a king could possibly want. She was raised to be a queen. I think, she had it was entitlement to be a queen, but it was because she didn't know anything else. That's what she was, and she was perfect for it. So she would have the answer to everything, which I think would be exciting.
Having those two together would be a fun experience, Catherine and Cromwell. That'd be fun.
I mean, Cromwell fought the world of Catherine, even though we had
absolutely
to oppose her. He was amazed by her strength.
And a bit of a random one. Do you love or do you hate roller coasters?
I hate them. I've always had very long hair and this paranoia that it was somehow going to get caught in it. I know
Oh.
that sounds ridiculous. I've only ever been on one ever, and that was on a school trip, and I had to be the parent who went to accompany the
Oh.
children.
Yeah.
So I got about 35 years without having to go on one, and I did not enjoy it at all.
Do you collect anything?
Books,
Yeah.
definitely.
Hey, I think most
I
of us.
got a Yeah, I got a book in the mail this morning with a little bookmark that said, "It's not hoarding if it's books." That's definitely what I'm collecting.
Exactly. That's what I say to my hubby every time the delivery guy rocks up and leaves several packages. And he just looks at me and I
Yes.
say, well, it's not a problem. It's books. It's fine.
Yeah, it's education. That's important.
Exactly. Now, what advice would you give your younger self if you had the opportunity?
Oh my gosh. Don't get married at age 20 would probably would be my number one. I think that things I haven't lived my life in a sort of traditional order, and I think I would say it's okay if the first thing you try doesn't work out. You don't have to be so hard on yourself because we don't know how things are going to turn out, especially now. You know, the whole world's been turned on its head. I think it doesn't matter if something doesn't work right away, or even the second or third time, because eventually you are going to find a spot where you're happy. That would be my tip to anyone,
Yeah,
really. It's
that's really
okay, you
great.
know.
Yeah, that's great advice. I really like that advice. And lucky last, you mentioned obviously the global pandemic. What's something new that you've learned during this? And I don't necessarily mean like you've taken up painting or something, just something maybe that you've discovered, I suppose, about humans, about the world, anything like that.
We had a lockdown here. I was in the hospital for a lot of it, so that made it a bit complicated. I come out and how everyone, I think the world had been stopped. Our lockdown was extreme. You couldn't go out unless you really, really had to. And it seemed that everyone quite enjoyed to just stop everything. The world just came to a halt. And actually, it was really good for a lot of people. I know it certainly was for my family. It was time to just stop everything, stop school, work, travel, all the obligations we have. And it just becomes so much. And I was just hoping once we release and we can go back to our lives that we can make changes and change priorities. Unfortunately, that did not happen. Our country has been full steam ahead 3 months without any COVID. Everybody almost tried to almost try harder now that we're out of lockdown and even stress out more. And here we are. We are now back in lockdown this week for 3 days, and I think maybe we need to take a look at how we can change our priorities. I certainly feel like I have to.
All right, very last thing, and then I'll let you get back on with your day, is our tutor takeaway. So I ask all my guests for a little tutor takeaway, something that our listeners can go and check out after the episode. So do you have a tutor takeaway for us?
I did see a comment last week from someone, and she said, we were talking about Cromwell and
Yes.
Hilary Mantel's books, and she said that she had to rely on historical fiction as fact because she doesn't have access to primary sources and information, and most people don't. And I thought, you can actually access a lot of things online, even if you just want to go basic. You can, you know, you go to British History Online through the British Library, you can read the transcripts of a lot of letters. It's not exact, but it's a really good starting point to look at the letters and papers of Henry VIII. If you say, oh, I can't access these things, I sort of feel like, you know, you can. Don't feel like it's sort of just for academics. If you
Yes.
want to look at something, if even if you're just looking at some pictures of letters and you can't understand how to read it, there are ways that you can do that. You don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to be an expert. And if you want to look at things, you can. There are different levels. And I thought there should be a way that people can feel as if they can try that for themselves. Don't feel like that's just for some people and then you just get this. I feel like there are some things, particularly the BHO. I think you look at that. I think it's a really good starting point for people. Don't feel like that's just for the academics or the authors. It's for everybody. Don't feel like you can't or you shouldn't be. Because I sort of got the impression from these comments, or that's just for the
Yes.
academics.
Yeah.
All we've got is historical fiction, so don't be nasty to us for not having it right. Don't feel like you can't. Don't feel like it's too snobby. You can definitely get in there yourself. You know, I didn't start out life as an academic, and now I'm writing this book. You know, I only have a history diploma. Anyone can do it. Don't feel like you're excluded. That would be my takeaway.
Yeah, and I love that. And you are echoing sentiments of people that I've interviewed that work at, you know, places like the National Archives, and they're desperately trying to communicate the exact same message. Those documents, the primary sources, are for all of us. We all have access to them if we'd like to. And I think that's a really fantastic takeaway that you've given us there. So thank you very much. Great reminder. And I will put in our show notes, you know, links to your website and also some links to those resources that you've just mentioned, like the wonderful letters and papers of Henry, the reign of Henry VIII, which we all love to go and have a little look at. So thank you so much, Caroline, for taking time to chat with me. And I cannot wait to hear about your new book.
Thank you so much. I could talk about Tom forever. So it is not a problem.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.